Lindsay Boxer stands on her apartment terrace, service revolver pressed against her temple. This haunting image opens James Patterson's psychological thriller about a homicide detective battling both serial killers and a devastating personal diagnosis. The newlyweds David and Melanie Brandt celebrate their wedding night in the Grand Hyatt's Mandarin Suite, surrounded by roses and champagne. David gives his bride diamond earrings, whispering tenderly, "It's you who pulls my tides." Their romantic moment is shattered when a man identifying himself as Philip Campbell arrives, brutally murdering both of them. The crime scene Lindsay encounters the next day is particularly disturbing. Despite expensive jewelry present, nothing was stolen. The bride's underwear had been pulled down, suggesting sexual assault after death. Most peculiarly, the killer switched jackets with the groom and left behind an expensive bottle of champagne. These strange details hint at something far more sinister than robbery, a killer with a specific, twisted ritual. And on this same day, Lindsay receives devastating news. She has Negley's aplastic anemia, a potentially fatal condition. With this double burden, a horrific murder investigation, and a life-threatening illness, Lindsay must somehow find the strength to continue. When a second couple is murdered at a Napa Valley winery, Lindsay, overwhelmed by both the case and her illness, makes an unconventional decision. She invites her friend Claire Washburn, the medical examiner, and Cindy Thomas, an ambitious crime reporter, to discuss the case informally. Over margaritas at Susie's restaurant, the three women form an immediate bond. With Claire's toast of In Margaritas Veritas, the Women's Murder Club is born. The group later expands to include Jill Bernard, a tough assistant district attorney. Together, these four women create a formidable team, combining their skills and access to information in ways that bypass bureaucratic limitations. Each brings something essential. Claire's scientific brilliance, Cindy's investigative tenacity, Jill's legal expertise, and Lindsay's detective instincts. Sometimes the most effective teams form outside official channels. When systems fail us, we create our own networks, and often these improvised alliances prove more powerful than traditional structures. As more newlyweds fall victim, a disturbing pattern emerges. The murderer strikes within 24 hours of weddings, showing intimate knowledge of victims' schedules. He takes only wedding rings, ignoring valuable jewelry, revealing a ritualistic aspect. Bodies are arranged in sexually explicit poses, with evidence of post-mortem assault on female victims. The third attack marks a bold escalation. James and Kathy Voskuhl are murdered at Cleveland's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame during their own wedding reception. This shift to killing in a crowded venue suggests growing confidence and desire for notoriety. The team uncovers their first substantial evidence, a distinctive reddish-brown beard hair from inside Rebecca DeGeorge's body. Their breakthrough comes when Claire suggests the killer might target brides through wedding dress shops. Lindsay discovers both early victims purchased dresses from the bridal boutique at Saks, where a folder with detailed bride information had disappeared shortly before the murders began. The violation transcends physical harm. It perverts something pure and celebratory into something deadly. The investigation pivots when Lindsay connects the murders to Nicholas Jenks, a best-selling novelist with a reddish-gray beard. Evidence accumulates rapidly. He had a relationship with one victim, connections to the winery where the second couple was found, and had purchased the rare champagne found at the first crime scene. He also owned a Glock matching the Cleveland murder weapon. When confronted at his Golden Gate Bridge home, Jenks first denies knowing victim Kathy Kogut, then changes his story when shown phone records, claiming he merely mentored her. His refusal to provide a hair sample heightens suspicion. The clincher comes from Jenks's ex-wife, who reveals his unpublished first novel featured a character who goes around killing brides and grooms, a lot like what happened. The manuscript contains disturbing similarities to the actual crimes. Lindsay arrests Jenks, who furiously claims they're making the biggest mistake of your little life. With the case seemingly solved, Lindsay begins a relationship with her partner, Chris Raleigh, allowing herself a moment of hope despite her illness. Lindsay notices a troubling detail about Jenks. He's left-handed, while Claire determined the killer was likely right-handed. This discrepancy makes Lindsay question whether they've arrested the right man. After an earthquake strikes San Francisco, Jenks escapes custody. Meanwhile, Claire makes a breakthrough discovery. Urine found at the first crime scene contained yeast cells and red blood cells, indicators of menstruation. This proves the killer was female, not Nicholas Jenks. At Jenks's ex-wife's apartment, Lindsay finds her murdered. Outside, she spots someone resembling Jenks, but realizes it's a woman in disguise. At the Palace of Fine Arts, Lindsay discovers the real killer is Chessie Jenks, Nicholas's current wife. Disguised with dyed hair and a fake beard, Chessie has been murdering newlyweds and framing her husband. She explains she targeted brides because they reminded her of herself, innocent women destroyed by Nicholas's cruelty and abuse. In the final confrontation, Lindsay is forced to shoot Chessie, but not before Chris Raleigh is fatally wounded. The novel climaxes when Lindsay finds Chris dying in a pool of blood. She tells him they caught the killer, and his final words, a weak but proud, "That's my girl," capture their bond before he dies in her arms. The cruel irony? Lindsay was diagnosed with a fatal disease, yet Chris was the first to die. Grief drives Lindsay toward depression and suicidal thoughts. Only the thought of betraying Chris's memory, his sacrifice and belief in justice, keeps her going. His funeral honors his service with bagpipes, a 21-gun salute, and officers standing at attention. A month later, Nicholas Jenks appears at Lindsay's apartment, revealing that he and Chessie planned the bride and groom killings as novel research, but Chessie deviated from their plan. When Jenks attacks Lindsay with a hunting knife, she reaches her backup revolver despite her injuries and kills him. Justice served at a terrible cost. Her only call is to her three friends, Claire, Cindy, and Jill, who rush to her side, proving some bonds remain unbreakable even in darkness. First to Die offers no easy answers in a world where systems often fall short. The legal system proves inadequate, allowing a guilty Jenks to escape after being framed. Lindsay's final confrontation delivers justice outside legal boundaries, yet this violent resolution can't restore what's been lost. What remains constant amid these failures is the Women's Murder Club's unwavering strength. As traditional supports crumble, the department's politics, the justice system's flaws, even Lindsay's failing health, the bonds between these four women grow stronger. Their friendship transcends professional obligations, offering emotional support despite overwhelming obstacles. Solving the crime isn't enough. Trauma remains. Systemic flaws persist. But friends who understand both strength and vulnerability provide something perhaps more valuable than justice, knowing you don't face darkness alone. In a world where monsters wear wedding rings and write bestsellers, where brides become targets and detectives confront mortality, perhaps the most powerful weapon isn't a service revolver or brilliant deduction. It's a friend's hand reaching out, saying simply, "I'm here."